This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is EPA Agriculture Advisor Rod Snyder. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with EPA's Rod Snyder next. Did you know that the price of sugar for American households has recently been 5% lower than in other developed countries? In the U.S., 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers produce sugar under some of the world's highest safety, labor, and environmental standards. These hardworking Americans support more than 151,000 jobs in over two dozen states. They maintain a reliable domestic supply chain and contribute over $23 billion to the economy each year. American sugar companies pay fair wages and offer good benefits to their workers, including union jobs that are vital to rural and urban communities. The sugar program is the safety net for sugar producers in the Farm Bill. It has strong bipartisan support in Congress and is designed to cost the taxpayer nothing. The current sugar program provides flexibility to allow for a reliable supply throughout the year and to accommodate imported foreign sugar required under our trade commitments. Weakening the sugar program would lead to greater dependence on unreliable foreign suppliers, costing us, American farmers, good-paying jobs, and domestic food security for this essential ingredient. For more, visit the American Sugar Alliance at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Prior to accepting the position of EPA Agriculture Advisor, Rod Snyder had spent 20 years working for farmers and agriculture associations. Today he stands in a position to offer practical and common sense messages to the EPA decision-making table. Snyder says EPA often finds itself in the middle of legal opinions by farm groups and NGOs.
We get sued by everybody on everything. I mean, it is part of the process, and the public has access to the courts to be able to bring those types of grievances forward. And you're right. Sometimes it's environmental NGOs. Sometimes it's farm groups. That's just part of the process that we expect. But I think Administrator Regan, you know, my boss, has been incredibly conscientious to try to understand the perspectives of all sides. And you don't always have that at EPA. Sometimes you've got an administration that tilts entirely one direction or the other. Administrator Regan has really tried to ensure that diverse stakeholders' perspectives are understood and brought into the room for these kinds of decisions. So just last week, we were out at a farm in Wisconsin. We had a roundtable with a bunch of the Wisconsin ag leadership from around the state. And every time we have those conversations, we learn something new. We hear something important that we can take back and bring into our decision-making process. And Administrator Regan has been committed to that level of communication and transparency from the day he arrived in 2021. And I've appreciated that about his approach, knowing that at the end of the day, some of this stuff's going to end up in court. Like you said, it's going to get litigated, but we want to make sure that we're having open lines of communication and that we're following the science and following the law as best as possible.
Does the EPA have adequate staff?
So Jeff, thanks for asking that question, because the resource issues are always front of mind. And I would say it's particularly of interest within the pesticide program. And one of the things that we saw in the prior appropriation cycle, not the one that we're in now, but the FY23 appropriation cycle, is we actually saw farm groups and the ag chemical industry go up to the Hill and say to Congress that the agency doesn't have enough resources to carry out its work. Now, that's unusual, right? I mean, you normally say, well, the folks want to cut EPA's budget and, you know, limit their authorities. But for us to bring new products to market, for us to bring the science to bear, to review and approve chemistries and new products, requires people to do that work. And our agency's budget has been pretty flat for over a decade. The number of Office of Pesticide Program staff at its peak was between 800 and 900 people. We're down to around 500. that's going to create delays, that it does create inefficiencies and delays. And so Congress did increase the Office of Pesticide Program's funding levels by about $10 million last year. And we also, they approved the Pesticide Registration Improvement Act, which raised some of the industry fees that the chemical companies pay to try to help to improve that situation. But it's a long game. This is going to take a while to dig us out of that hole because we've been flat for so long.
Are the current FIFRA laws and other regulations that we have on the books, are they adequate to measure new crop protection products, seed treatments, biologicals that are coming to the marketplace?
I mean, I would say that I think the United States has the best regulatory system in the world. And it is a science-based, risk-based statute, risk-benefit statute that allows the agency to look at human health and environmental impacts. Also, what is the economic benefit of these products to farmers? That's all built into the statute. And so I think when I talk to our science, I'm not a scientist myself, but when I talk to our technical team within the Office of Pesticide Programs, I'm proud of the work they do, and I think they're the best in the world. And as I said before, the resource issues are a challenge. We're trying to cover. There are more and more registration applications coming in now than ever before. And the complexity of the products are greater than ever before. You have all different types of emerging classes of chemistries and new technologies that we have to keep up with. But I still stand by our scientists every day of the week, and I think we have the best regulatory system in the world.
So talking about gene-edited products, the USDA has made its statement, but EPA has not as yet.
We had a rulemaking that we finalized earlier this year that, in consultation with other federal agencies and stakeholders as well, that did create a more efficient route to approve PIPs, plant-incorporated pesticides. Mm-hmm. It did create some classes that are exempt from more robust regulatory overview, so we did take a step in that direction. We've gotten feedback from the industry that they'd like us to go further than we went, and we're taking that under consideration, and there's things like plant growth regulators and other types of new technologies that we're looking at. How do we improve and make that regulatory process more efficient? I saw USDA's announcement this week. I haven't had time to talk with them yet on that, just very recent. But just know that EPA is involved in those conversations as well. And the PIPs rule that we finalized earlier this fall is one example.
So is it frustrating from your perspective representing agriculture at the Environmental Protection Agency, knowing that we have easily the most stringent system, a science-based system for registration and re-registration, but yet to see products that you have approved challenged in courtrooms and states that want to add on to the labeling to talk about science that you've seen but you didn't necessarily follow?
Look, I mean, I don't want to be too critical of what is, I think, also the best judicial system in the world too, right? It's part of the process, and citizens have the ability to bring forward cases, and sometimes courts agree with the agency and sometimes they don't. And sometimes that cuts the way of agriculture, and sometimes it cuts the other way. And so, that's just part of the process. But at the end of the day, I still think our scientists are the best in the world. I certainly stand by, the types of decisions that they're making, but then we'll also have our day in court sometimes where we have to defend those decisions. That's just part of the process.
It's just watching the situation where the EPA has done its due diligence and the company has done its due diligence in advance. And through all of this testing and approval and the rest, a court, it's a judge or a jury of peers, then these things are coming to bear. And the issue is it affects farmers and their ability to produce product or companies that are even willing to invest. I mean, they openly suggest that in our choice of where we research and what we do, if we think there's going to be a consumer pushback on it, we don't go there.
Well, I mean, let me give an example, and I don't want to get ahead of your questions here, but a prime example of one of the things you're talking about is, for many years now, EPA has been, our pesticide program has been sued on the Endangered Species Act. Many cases now, dozens of cases. we will, I think it's now at this point safe to acknowledge that, that the agency wasn't doing everything it needed to under the Endangered Species Act when we were registering these products. Now, I'll say, under FIFRA, there's an ecological review where we look at the environmental impacts of the products that we register, but there's a separate statute, the Endangered Species Act, that requires a different level of information and also consultation with other agencies to ensure that we're not impacting, unreasonably impacting these listed species. We didn't have a process for decades. We did not have a process to do that. And so environmental groups use their rights under the law to bring some ESA cases to federal courts. And guess what? We've lost those cases because we didn't have a process. So this administration in the last year, in 2022, for the first time ever, published a comprehensive Endangered Species Act work plan to try to bring our pesticide registration program into compliance with the ESA. The reason why I think that's important and positive for farmers is that these registrations need to be defensible in federal court, in a court of law, if we expect to have some predictability around the types of products that are available on the market. So we have taken a proactive step for the first time ever after decades of this problem festering to try to bring the program into compliance. We put out a herbicide strategy this year. We're looking at how do we look at practices that farmers can use to help reduce runoff or reduce drift that might have some off-target impact. These are things that courts have told us are long overdue and we need to work on. What I think is important about the steps we've taken in the last year or two is that we're trying to take control of our own destiny. Because if we don't solve this ESA problem, judges and courts are going to solve it for us. And that may not go the way that farmers want. But if we can actually put a process in place to try to say, we're going to comply with ESA, we're going to make sure that listed species are not being harmed through use of these products, then we can help shore up those labels in a way that can provide defensibility and predictability for farmers in the long term. So that's why we've been doing that.
So I can understand through the judicial system of why you would look and say, you're right, we need to correct this, and you're in the process of doing that now. But Rod, what about glyphosate? Because you stood behind that product, you know, and said that it was okay, but yet you've had other courts and other states that have challenged this product, and punitive damages have been awarded. It's almost as if the registration and the regulatory system that we have is on trial.
Well, I don't want to editorialize too much except for to say that the agency's position with respect to glyphosate is unchanged. Our scientists have been consistent about whether or not glyphosate is carcinogenic. They've said that it is not. That is the position that the agency has taken in these court cases as well. I also noticed that the EU has renewed glyphosate in Europe for another 10 years. You know, Australia, Canada, there are other scientific bodies around the world that have come to the same conclusion as the United States. I'm not setting the EU aside, but I just thought it was interesting that that announcement just came out today. But there are other countries that have come to the same conclusion about glyphosate, that it can be safely used. And that continues to be the position of this agency. I don't want to editorialize about various court decisions, except for to say I think our scientists are standing by the continued safe use of the product. Our team shows up every day to do its job, to bring the best science to bear. We will continue to follow the science and follow the law.
Let's move to this area. Waters of the U.S. Boy, you talk about a revolving door of definitions, three different administrations and three different sets of rules. You did have the Supreme Court that weighed in the Sackett case, where significant nexus was certainly challenged and there was a definitive answer. Many ag groups thought that you were going to rewrite the rule, but instead the rule was amended. Why did you choose that path, and do you feel like the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed here?
So, I mean, as you know, Jeff, the long tail of this issue is now decades old, and I want to start by saying I share, I think, frustration with farmers and landowners about how unsettled this has been for so long. We are now on our third U.S. Supreme Court case. We're on our third, or I guess fourth if you consider the amended rule, in the last 8 years. It does create a lot of uncertainty in terms of what might be jurisdictional and what isn't. Administrator Regan, when he arrived at the agency in 2021, one of the things that he indicated is that we have to come up with something that's durable and stands the test of time, so we're not ping-ponging back and forth like we've seen for a number of years. So the rule that we put out in January of this year, in January of 2023, was intended to be a middle ground approach between the prior two administrations. We know the Obama and Trump rules were both vacated. We needed to find something that was more in the middle of those two approaches. And we thought, you know, we think we've done that. Included in that rule were things like very explicit exclusions for agriculture. We built into the actual regulatory text exclusions for prior converted cropland, certain ditches, artificially irrigated areas, features that, farm ponds, features that will never fall under federal jurisdiction, and we wanted to be very direct and clear about that. The Sackett case, when it was handed down in May, was looking at, perhaps important but narrow questions around things like, is the significant nexus test going to stand? And they were very clear that the answer is no. That needed to, the Rapanos case from 2006, that it set up the two dueling tests, the significant nexus test is no longer legal. And so, we didn't feel that we had any discretion once that decision was made in May. We needed to move quickly, and also very directly to respond to what the court said. And we did it in as efficient and expeditious fashion as possible. So in August, the amended rule dealt with the issues that the Supreme Court specifically dictated to us. That was important for a couple reasons, but mainly the Army Corps of Engineers had paused jurisdictional determinations for certain types of JDs after the Sackett case and until the final rules amended. So we moved fast because folks were waiting on their determinations around the country while the Army Corps had paused JDs. So that August rule is now out there. We believe that it is fully in compliance with the U.S. Supreme Court. It preserves the agricultural exclusions and some of the other provisions that we had put into the January rule, so those still remain there. We're going to work closely not just with Army Corps, but also with USDA as we implement this, because we want to make sure that the types of wetlands determinations that USDA is making, that we're doing this in a consistent fashion. The last thing I'll say is that, of course, as we have said, there are still a couple court cases hanging out there. And in 27 states right now, the new rule is stayed. It's not being implemented. In 23 states, it is. So we're waiting on the results of those outstanding, those remaining court cases to determine where we go from here. We want to get to a place where all 50 states are playing by the same set of rules. We want to get to a place where unquestionably the definitions that we have in place are going to remain and that they're not going to be overturned in court. It's important for the environment, but it's also important for farmers and landowners to know going forward, this is exactly the rules of the road. And just because whoever's in the White House is not going to change again in 4 years. That's critically important. And that's the place we're trying to get.
I think there was a rub from some farm groups that there wasn't a comment period on the amended rule.
Totally understand that feedback. But just to say, this was a highly unusual situation. We issued what was called a good cause rule. It's not done very often, but we felt that we had no discretion based on what the Supreme Court issued. We had received 120,000 or more comments earlier on the initial rule, on the final rule from January. We had just gotten an enormous amount of public comment, of which we incorporated a lot of that into the rule. The Supreme Court's ruling was quite clear and quite direct, and it didn't matter if we got a million public comments. We had to respond to what the Supreme Court said, and we needed to do it fast, which is why we took this course of action.
One of the points that American Farm Bureau has brought up is of the relatively permanent. They feel like there might still be some vague clauses in there. They're looking for an accurate definition, and they feel like that relatively permanent and some other things like that aren't really clear black and white. They don't know how to interpret from themselves.
The relatively permanent standard is the one that now remains after the Sackett case, and so it is quite important. It's now basically everything sort of hangs on that. And we there's certainly language within the rule that helps to clarify that, but also I think we've said, our Office of Water has said, that we are thinking about additional guidance, or at least information out to the local core districts and others to help make decisions around determining what is relatively permanent or not. That's an ongoing conversation, and one in which you would expect to see probably additional information coming from the agency in the coming months.
So let's drift over, if we can, into renewable fuel, which is a big issue for a lot of folks in different places, and it's been a polar issue as well. The tailpipe emission standards that have been proposed, you had a comment period on that. Can you give the nature, or have you had a chance to review those comments and what folks might have said?
Yeah, I mean, I work much more closely on the renewable fuel standard rulemakings, of which we can talk about that as well. The tailpipe standard, I'm not as directly and immediately involved in. However, I think one of the things we heard from biofuels groups and farmers is just making sure that that it is a technology neutral approach, that there are multiple ways to try to get to these greenhouse gas emissions, you know, these various emissions reductions, that we can do this in such a way that whether it's electric vehicles or biofuels or low carbon fuels, that there's multiple ways to get to that endpoint. And that's certainly something that Administrator Regan is very committed to. And I think our rulemaking process on the renewable fuel standard side also signals a level of commitment to growing the biofuel sector. This is an all of the above strategy. It's not just about EVs or ethanol or biodiesel. It's about all of the above. And so I think if you look at the collection of all the rulemakings we made in this transportation space, if you take that collectively as a picture, you can see that we're trying to signal a variety of ways to get to our outcome.
Again, I think there were some that had an idea the EPA was mandating to the vehicle manufacturers the direction that might go. And possibly under that umbrella, we'd ask this question, with regard to the IRS determination, is the EPA considering, and when would you determine whether you would use the GREET model or not in evaluation of fuels?
Well, the Inflation Reduction Act has a couple of really important tax credits, one for sustainable aviation fuel, another clean fuel tax credit. And there, Congress put in specific greenhouse gas emissions reduction thresholds that have to be met for those tax credits to be issued. So it's really important that we get the science right. At the end of the day, that is the IRS's final decision about what sort of modeling they're going to use and in what context. But we are part of an interagency work group process, along with USDA, Department of Energy, and in the case of sustainable aviation fuel, also the FAA Department of Transportation. We are all contributing to a conversation around how we bring the best available science forward to help the IRS make that decision. We expect that in the coming, you know, weeks or months, they will provide guidance. Treasury Department, IRS will provide guidance on the modeling and what's allowable and what's not. And we are just one of the federal agencies that's part of that conversation. So yes, of course, we've heard loud and clear about the importance of the GREET model. There's other models and approaches out there. We're doing our best to just provide some technical expertise to the IRS, and then they'll make their decision.
All right. There were seven governors that asked for year-round E15 waivers, but yet they've not received a decision yet from EPA. So one question is there an idea when they may get an answer? And then the second, for the other 43 states for the summer of 2024,
yep,
when would the agency offer some guidance there?
Well, this, as you know, is also a longstanding, complicated issue that has its origins in the Clean Air Act itself and the parameters that Congress put on us. The last two summers, Administrator Regan has issued emergency waivers to allow for E15 sales nationwide. That's unprecedented, but it's also in direct response to the war in Ukraine and other sort of global impacts on the energy markets, to say we need to make sure that this domestically produced homegrown fuel is available uninterrupted for the last two summers. And that's been an important signal around our commitment to this. Going forward, there's a couple things happening. One is the Midwest governors have petitioned under the Clean Air Act to basically change the fuel blend stock for those states that would allow E15 to be sold. We are nearing the point where I think a final rule we're close to reaching that place. I think this was originally proposed in 2022. I know that folks are waiting for this to go over to OMB for interagency review. We're getting towards the end of that process. The other thing that's happening is, I know it's outside of our lane, but Congress continues to debate whether a legislative fix, which to your point goes well beyond seven or eight states that would solve the issue permanently through a legislative approach, those conversations are still happening as well in Congress. And I know there's been some bills introduced that in some ways would be a cleaner, easier, more comprehensive way to deal with this that we don't have the authority to do. And the last administration, to their credit, tried to do a rulemaking on E15 that enabled year-round sales, and it was thrown out. It was basically determined by a federal court that it was not an appropriate use of the statute to do it that way. So we're going to try to do our best to move forward with the governors as they petition, while also trying to see, is Congress going to step in here and do anything on their side of the hill as well?
Well, Rod Snyder, the last time that you and I talked, we were at a Farm Progress show, and we were talking about Field to Market. We'll follow you all the way through your career, and thanks for stopping now in your position with EPA and as a liaison for agriculture. But this microphone is open, and today you've got the last word.
Well, Jeff, I just really appreciate the invitation to be here. This is entirely the reason why an ag advisor exists at the agency. My door is always open. I can't tell you how many times per week I've got farm groups who are visiting Washington, D.C. that come into my door, come into my office. And I'm out on the road almost every week visiting farms and visiting ag events. And we just want to keep this two-way street of communication open. We make better informed decisions when farmers are at the table, and we just really appreciate the relationship.
Our thanks to EPA Agriculture Advisor Rod Snyder, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.